do your writing. Yeah, they're great. But it wasn't anything. It was just a little thing.
Yeah.
Go in your back pocket, yeah.
Well, I've got a little microcorder that I can carry around and put notes and stuff on. But this thing, I mean, this is my child. This is my baby.
Oh, yeah.
I love this. Let's see. There's a lot of questions that I know of to ask deck department people, but I don't know so much about the engine department.
What kind of questions would you ask the deck department?
Oh, I'd ask about how they how they kept their position in convoys. And
I can tell you.
I mean, I know how, but I'll ask.
We eventually, when Kings Point got going, they would put on each ship six cadets. They had to spend so many months at sea.
Six at once?
Three deck and three engine.
That's surprising. I've never heard of one of each.
Well, you had one on each watch then. And then the convoys we got into, the deck cadets, practically the only thing they do was handle the telephone with a destroyer. And they would tell them, change your course to this. But especially going to Iceland, it'd get so foggy. And it'd clear up sometimes, and we'd see all these icebergs and wonder how in the world. We didn't know. We didn't have radar at that time in the war. And we wondered, how the hell are they getting through all this stuff? And what they would do, they had radar, and they'd tell the ship, change your course to say, steer this right on through this for days. And we couldn't see a thing. But what does the mate do? That's what he does. He stands up there, especially in a convoy. You always got a commodore that's in charge. He's up in one of the lead ships. And we didn't have the walkie-talkies then, but they'd blink at him and tell him, well, we're going to change course, so-and-so. And they just stand there, stay in line. And then they finally, they had ship. I was on a ship one time. I come up out of the engine room. And the ship, next ship in line, was so close that these gun crew kids were throwing potatoes back and forth. That bow was right up here. And these kids, they didn't have a care of one. And they all be damn. I said, what are you doing? And they're throwing potatoes at the gang on the others. And then they came out with a rig they called a sled. And there's a long cable, and it had a thing that had a scoop under it, and you'd pull it, and the water would flare up in the air. Yeah. So that when you'd come up and you'd see that rooster tail, you'd know you were about 300 or 400 feet behind the guy. And that was a good indication so they didn't get up next to each other. But all they do is what they're told in a convoy. When we would get out, after we start running alone, of course, these skippers and I were quite friendly. What they would do, the Navy, wherever your port was, you'd go to the Navy, and they would give you your course to your next destination. And they'd tell us, don't break radio silence unless you get so far ahead or so far behind. That's the way you'd go.
Did you ever hear of any beliefs or practices or superstitions that might be considered to make a vessel lucky or unlucky?
No. Some people, I'm Irish, and I should be superstitious, but no, I could very honestly say I never heard anything that I'd figure was lucky or unlucky.
It's amazing because most of the people say exactly what you say, but every so often somebody will come up with something and, like, somebody said that it was unlucky to sail on a vessel named after a woman.
Yeah.
And I went, never heard that one. And then I've heard two or three times I've heard that you weren't supposed to take a second voyage on the same vessel. But
I was on the same ships for years. Never heard it. No, I don't. Maybe you go back to sailing ship days or something, you might. But present day seamen, I think they got too much to do and too much to think about get on to something like that. But I can't remember one instance where anybody said anything about unlucky.
Did you notice a distinct difference in the attitude of people ashore towards merchant mariners in the United States and in Great Britain?
No. I think you get more respect in Britain than any place. But never. During the war, we wore a uniform. I was in New York. I went up to Rockefeller Center to the Radio City Music Hall. I was standing there in line waiting to go someplace, and some lady took me for an usher. So there's New York for you.
Oh, dear me.
Any place that I've ever visited, they're all very friendly. I mean, if you have bad experiences, I think you brought it on yourself. Something you'd do. No.
What was the ethnic background of the crews that you sailed with?
In those days, mostly American kids. They might be Spanish, or they could be black, but not too many of them, but they're all just plain old American kids, educated in this country, and they all kind of thought the same, and they did their job, and no problems.
So, because the tankers had been the oil company ships for so long, you didn't get any of the expatriates that...
No, not in those days.
Because I've heard that a number of liberties and like that had...
Well, that may be...
Norwegians that had lost their ship or...
Well, I think if that happened, you'd be in a foreign port. You needed a crew member or something. Then they'd probably put one on. But no, not with us. We never... We picked up the... We've been in places where the council would try to get rid of some of these. There's always a bunch of bums. Or not a bunch, but there's a few. And the foreign country, the first one they turned to is the American consul, and of course he can't get rid of them fast enough, so if an American ship come in, he'd tell you, how about take this fella back here with you? Well, they were usually pretty useless individuals, or they wouldn't have been where they were, but no, the average were great. They're all good fellas. We never had any trouble with any of them.
And for the most part, everybody got along well? And
sure, we never had problems. No... Oh, we all got along real good. It's been my experience.
Let's see, is there anything else? I'm sure that I'll think of something that I wish I'd asked you, but if I don't think of it now, I'm tough out of luck.
Gun crew kids were mostly, to me, like kids from the Middle West. They were very ignorant about what, but they were just good American kids. But I had one instance. I was first assistant, and I was down in the engine room. I was on the 48 watch. And up on the next deck was a machine shop. And I was down there having a cup of coffee, and my mind probably wandering, and it was a big flash and a pile of smoke, and I thought, God damn, what happened? I went up there. Here's two of these gun crew kids. They had the 20-millimeter shells, and they were taking them apart and make souvenirs out of them. And they were putting the powder on the vice bench there. And I guess when they got a pile, this one kid threw a match. Well, that really ticked me off. I run them the hell out of there, and I got a hold of the gunnery officer, and I said, those kids got no business in that engine room. I never want to see another one down there. But they were just kids. Of course, they could have got hurt, too,
They could have got hurt. They could have damaged some equipment.
But they were kids that just didn't have any experience in that line of work, and they would normally do a pretty good job.
I know something that I'm interested in. I'm interested in, I don't know what to call it except nicknames. Things like calling a certain position Coffin Corner in a convoy, or names for different parts of the Atlantic?
Not really. We didn't get into that. A lot of outside rows nobody liked because they got it first. If you're in the middle, and one thing you'd notice, if we had any Navy, like I say, we used to have carriers in convoys. And they were so loaded down with equipment, there was no airplane. But they were always in the middle of the convoy. You never saw them on the outside. They had their protection. So I'd say if there's anything, being in a convoy would stay away from those outside lines. But coffin corners or anything like that, no, I never heard of it.
I've heard two or three different names for the space between the two air covers there near Iceland.
I never heard any names. They finally, towards the latter part, the last couple of years, you had an airfield in Reykjavik. Like I say, we used to go in there. And they start giving air cover for that area. And you could pretty well tell planes would come out and fly around you once in a while, out of Iceland.
Mm-hmm.
But I never heard of any name for it. We knew they came from Iceland. But one big worry we had in convoys in that North Atlantic, the Germans had a couple of big ships parked in those fjords in Norway. And we knew if one of them ever come out, a DE wouldn't have a show against them. He'd have slaughtered us. And when we would go to Reykjavik, we would pull into St. John's, Newfoundland, and refuel the destroyers, three destroyers. We came in there one time, and here's a big American battleship, like one of the new ones, with it, and a big aircraft carrier laying there at anchor. And we asked them, somebody, what in the world's going on? And they said, well, because of the Germans. If one of them comes out, we're going to be ready for them. Well, I doubt if anybody hear that. They wouldn't publicize that, but we were in there and we saw them sitting there. It made us feel a little better.
You know, I've been living in St. John's for the last 4 years.
Newfoundland? Is that right? No kidding. We didn't get ashore. We just go in there and refuel the destroyers.
They have finger piers then?
No, we didn't go to any dock. We just did it at anchor.
I just wondered because there's no piers.
No, we didn't get ashore. We could see the place there. But that battleship and carrier were laying there at anchor, too.
So what was this common practice to use St. John's for a refueling stop?
That was the stop we used. I don't know how common it was. I didn't see too much traffic around there. But we ran, I don't know how many trips, there'd be three destroyers, not DE, destroyers, and five tankers. That was our run.
And you stopped in and refueled there and then
went on. That was the only stop we made between New York and Reykjavik. Just the one there. Canal to Manchester. They call it the Manchester Ship Canal. And you went through one lock, and then you went up into a place they call Stanlow, which was a big oil depot. And we would pump out there. But a lot of times, we'd be there overnight, and as chief engineer, I think I'm going to get the hell off here for one night. I'd go over to a town of Chester, England. Have you been in Chester?
I've not been to the UK yet.
Oh, well, Chester, if you like things that are old, go to Chester. There's part of the Roman wall still around that town, and it is very, very old. But they had a couple pretty good hotels. I'd go up and spend the night, get off the ship for tonight. And then we would go, Liverpool most, to get rid of these airplanes. And then we made lots of trips to Glasgow. On the Ohio, we took the Ohio in there and pumped out our cargo. And then we went down that river to, there's a Loch Long down there. There's two towns, Greenock and Gourock. And we were at anchor and we had to get bunkers and water. We got all that. We were ready to go home. Here comes this damn launch and all this Navy brass. And first guy over the side says, "We're taking your ship." We ran there.
What did you think, that you had pirates?
No, it was British Navy. But then we ran her uptown, way, I guess as far as you could go, up the river into Glasgow, and they called the Princess Dock. I'll never forget that. And that's when they took us off eventually and put all the English on. But Glasgow, quite a town. Holy smoke, we were there about a month and a half before we could get transportation out. But I, while we're in Loch Long.
So you were ashore in Glasgow for about 6 weeks before you?
Yeah. We stayed in Barry's Ford Hotel on Socky Hall Street. But one time before we got there, while I was still down waiting to leave, I went ashore one day, and I went over to this Gourock, and there's a train to Glasgow. And those trains, you know, are compartments.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat down, and a lady came in, sat down opposite me, and she's looking me over. And finally, she says, you're an American, aren't you? And I said, I sure am. And she said, I'm from America. And I said, geez, I hear you talk, you never know it. She said, I'm from Wyoming. And I married an Englishman, I've been over here 20 years. And she lived across some little town, and she got telling me the home she lived in was over 400 years old. And those homes are stone and slate. And I said, geez, that would really be interesting. And she said, anytime you can come, you're welcome to come. She said, we entertain a lot of Corvette crews. And she said, be glad to have you. And I would have, but I never did make it.
Uh-huh. You just didn't have the opportunity.
No.
You
know, well, you'd have to get a little launch of some kind to get over there, and I didn't. But no. We eventually came home on the Monterey. Army Transport was operating the Monterey during the war. And we went
that
down.
Was the Lorleen Monterey?
Yeah.
I thought that was it. Yeah. I wanted to make sure.
They were hauling 4,000 or 5,000 troops on that thing. But we went home on back to New York. After the war was just over, and we come in, and they sent us up the English Channel to Bremen. First ship, first American ship, I guess, to get in at the end of the war. Bunch of submarines up on the breakwater. I guess they scuttled them. And we went in. They were telling us, you know, they have some kind of mine that they put down there, and propeller pulsations will set them off. And we were already in then. But there was some British Navy branch that had gone in there and found all these mines. I guess they got them all because we didn't set one off. I thought, what a job to go down that mud and find those. But that was an interesting trip. We went to Bremerhaven. It was the first place to pass. It was wrecked. And then we went up to Bremen, and then they had these submarine pens. And they had a big underground oil storage that will help to hit the belt to supply oil to that whole part of Germany. And that's what we eventually pumped into. But I ran into an army officer that had been a Texaco employee. And I was talking to him, and he said, I got a Jeep. Would you like to go up to Bremen? And I said, I sure would. And so I had a tour of Bremen. And there's one site I'll never forget. Any building is built with a steel frame. All the bricks come off of it, and the steel frame is here. But the roadway, just piles of brick. And all I see was safes all along, the doors open. And I said, gee, look at all the safes. He said, the English were the first ones in here, and they seemed to know where every safe was. And they dug them out. I busted them open, I guess.
Correct.
Well, that town was a mess. It was really tore up.
Nothing like a bunch of Brit safe crackers.
Oh, yeah. But if you can think of anything, I'd be glad to help you. Pictures don't mean anything to you, do they?
Oh, yeah, I like them, but it's unfortunate that I do not have a traveling copying machine.
Oh.
That means that I can't take copies of all the things I'd like to have copies of.
We had a fellow on the ships that was quite an artist, and he used to draw these, the American was his name, Al American. And this is a little publication the company put out. I'll give it to you. But this is one of his, what happens in the New York office.
Uh-huh. And here, the expedited, yeah. Really expediting as hard as they can. The
Department of Indoctrination, front, back, and bottom. In other words, this is the view of people, their ideas, what's going on up there.
Mm-hmm.
But this one here has...
I like that where they were picking the yes.
Yeah, well, you can have that.
Thank you. I like that where they were picking the officers for the shifts, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. An outsider's view of what happens in the New York office. Did you get all the dope?
I like this one, too. That guy's standing on tiptoe with his one foot behind the other ankle.
Yeah. Oh, the fellow was very clever. Every one of those publications, old Al would have something in there. Yeah, the Montana. Well, that's those other pictures, mm-hmm. This was before the wreck. They had them all painted gray, of course. And... some guy, we had these old life rafts, and some guy, or it had shook loose, or it was in the water floating around, and most of us eventually swam over and got to that thing.
So there was one life raft that made it?
Well, there was two on each side. That one on the other side was floating around. There were a bunch of guys on it when I went in the water, and we got on it. But the bad thing was the goddamn water was all afire. That gas.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some ships.
So you managed to avoid getting at least seriously burned.
Oh, I didn't get... Yeah, I didn't... but I'll tell you one thing. You're not taking this down, I hope. Because 3 days, they had a usable runway. And there's a captain from Bayonne, New Jersey, who we got to know. And we'd have him out the ship for lunch once in a while. And he took us, Skipper and I, and showed us around what he'd done. And then they had a recreation room up by this airfield. And they couldn't fly at night. These guys would fly these planes in, and then in the evening they'd go up and have a beer and talk and shoot the bull. And we went up there and had a couple of beers, too, with them. But down in the town, they had a U.S. Navy base with a lieutenant commander in charge. And they would, this is a typical mooring. You ever see these moorings up the coast where the ship's back in, mm-hmm. tied up to the buoys? Same, they had one of those. And they'd come out with a launch and take the lines and all this. I didn't see anything. I said, what were these Navy kids? And, oh, that commander won't let them come up here. Well, I thought it's the craziest thing in the world. A bunch of American fellas, you'd think, holy smoke, away from home, they'd at least get together and talk. No business. So that's my experience that way.
As far as your experience goes, the Army was real friendly and generous and...
Much friendlier.
And the Navy was very...
Very standoffish.
Aloof.
Very standoffish. To me. I mean, they... matter of fact, we were in Recife one time. We had boiler trouble. I'm chief engineer. Well, we're not overloaded with personnel, and I'm down there working with the rest of them. And we went to Rio, and the fella come aboard, and he said, God damn, Murph, what'd you do up in Recife? I said, what do you mean, what'd we do in Recife? Well, the Navy went aboard, and they said they went in your room, and they couldn't find any engineers around. I thought, God damn, why'd you come down the engine room, and you find us all, we're all working on the boiler? But the guy put in a report.
If I were going to look for an engineer, and I didn't find him in his room, I think I'd check the engine room to find out.
But the silly guy, he put in a report. Went aboard the ship and no engineering officers in sight. I mean, I went to the rooms, and, well, we were all down working on that damn boiler because we had to leave the next day and get her ready. But the report had got down to Rio, and this guy come aboard and told me.
Brilliant.
So that was kind of sad.
I did have a story from one guy who was on a destroyer about he was in the Aleutians, I think, and he was on the wheel, and there was this young officer who was up on the bridge, and the captain told him that he was going to go down to his room and that he wanted them to keep position on the one Liberty ship that they were with. And when he came back, the guy had locked the radar on it.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And he said, "What's wrong? Is there something wrong with the radar?" The guy says, "No, sir, you told me to keep position on it, and I just figured the easiest way to do it was them getting constant readings from the radar." And he said at that point that the officer turned to this guy and he said, "You're relieved of deck duty. You're relieved of fridge duty. And I'm going to turn you into a chief engineer."
Well, that to me, that's all uncalled for because it's lack of experience. I had a fellow one time telling me, I don't know if you know, down the engine room, you carry vacuum on the, and about the maximum you get is 30 inches of vacuum. And this gauge had a little more room, and this guy was putting 31, 32. And I come down and I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, I just thought that I got a little more space, I'd add a few more numbers on there." But the kid's okay. He did, you know, he should have asked me first, but then I had another kid. Matter of fact, I had a Christmas card from him. I was back in the steering engine room, and you're right over the propeller. And I could hear this. I said, "This son of a gun is slowing down." So I busted ass down the fire room. And this kid is standing there looking. He said, "The steam is going down." George Terrell. I'll never forget his name. Steam's going. Sure as hell. They were all automatic. And what he was doing, this, we call a Bailey board, he was going to wipe it off, and he'd hit this one lever that worked easier than it should, and kicked it off automatic is what happened, disconnected the thing. So it was all going in the bilges. But poor old George didn't know. He said, "The steam's going down." Everything was going down.
But it didn't take anything to just...
Oh, no, I could see right away, and I put her back and brought her back up. But with the engine drawing all that steam, it had gone down pretty fast, you know.
Poor kid, he was only trying to do it.
But I say these things, I don't know, not that I think I'm unusual or anything, but there are people that just things don't soak in too fast. And they're conscientious enough, and they have to, even actually tell them a lot of times they're slow on the pickup, but he, no.
Yeah, I heard of one guy one time that was trying to work the engine room telegraph, was told to put her in full ahead, and he said he couldn't get it into Bendix.
Well, he got no business up there. No business up there, no.
He was trying to shove it into Bendix there.
That's like a time on this Montana when they had the collision. That thing, we're going so fast, and when he hit it, that stern started jumping. I mean, it really was jumping up and down, and I thought they must be, a lot of the time you get near close to the bottom, what they call sucking the bottom. I thought, these sons of guns don't know it. I slowed the engine down a little, and I went over to the, we had a silencer hood on the telephone. You'd stick your head under there and call. And about that time, the goddamn thing blew up, and that silencer jumped up and come down on my head. But, but I was trying to call the gang on the bridge, and hell, I guess they, by that time, they're all, the fire was all over the place, and they didn't know. When he exploded, it blew the skylights right off the goddamn engine room, and I looked up, and all I could see is fire, and all this stuff coming down. Holy smoke. But we were very fortunate to get off the damn thing.
Yeah. If 2/3 of you made it, that's pretty good under the circumstances.
But boy, you go up. They have fire extinguishers, you know, in the alleyways. You know. They had jumped off, and that goddamn foam was all over the place.
Well.
But I had one good friend. He was on watch with me. He traveled on different ships with me for quite a while. And he was on watch with me when that happened. And I told this engine room, I says, you guys, I don't know what the hell has happened, but you better get your life preserver because we're going to have to get off. And I went up to my room and had my coveralls hanging there, and I grabbed my, like I tell, the whole goddamn room was afire. Who the hell comes in but Elmer looking for me? Are you okay, Murph? And I said, yeah, I'm okay, Elmer. Come on now, we'll go see about the old chief. But there aren't many people do that. It's... You'd be surprised, people will say, well, I will do this, and they're just the ones that will do just the opposite. When really something really happens, it takes somebody with a pretty good head to say, oh, calm and try to do.
And he got up safely, too.
Oh, yeah, he died. He was up in Oregon. He died a couple of years ago. But people, you don't know what you're going to do in a real bad emergency.
Oh, no. Never know until it happens. Well, I think I'm going to have to stop because I'm blinking again.
Okay. Something comes up, I...
End of interview, end of tape C782, Northeast Archives of Folklore and Oral History, accession number 2196.